The Writer Files, a member of the Podglomerate Network.
One of the big downsides of writing is it's such a solitary profession. And so I think that anything that brings you out into the world and puts you in a group of people, especially a bar, it's just a gregarious setting, and alcohol tends to loosen people up. So it's a good antidote to the writer's dilemma. You know, it's not enough to be good. You have to be a little lucky too. I remember hearing an interview with Paul McCartney, and somebody asked him once if, when he was composing songs with Lennon, whether he could tell which ones were going to be hits and which ones couldn't. And he said that not only could he not tell which songs were the hits, whenever he tried to guess, he was always wrong. And I had a little bit of that experience with Defending Jacob too. It didn't seem to me like there was anything obviously better or worse about it, but it just took off.
And welcome back to The Writer Files. I am your humble host, Kelton Reed, wishing you pages, patience, and perseverance per usual. Award-winning and New York Times best-selling novelist William Landay spoke with me about how former lawyers get pigeonholed in publishing, why we can't get enough true crime, and his latest, All That Is Mine, I Carry With Me. William is a former assistant district attorney and the best-selling author of Defending Jacob, recently adapted into the Emmy-nominated Apple TV Plus series starring Chris Evans. His eagerly anticipated follow-up is All That Is Mine, I Carry With Me, available for pre-sale now and on sale March 7th from Bantam. A March 2023 Library Reads pick, described by New York Times bestselling author Scott Turow as masterful, original, and riveting, with its subtle mystery and compelling portraits of how lives are transformed in the aftermath of violent crime. New York Times bestselling author Joseph Finder said of the author, "With All That Is Mine, I Carry With Me, the masterful author of Defending Jacob has created something unforgettable and original, unlike any other crime novel I've read." In this file, William and I discussed the double-edged sword of a two-book deal, why service industry jobs are great for writers, the strange surprise of writing a runaway bestseller, the long tale of Defending Jacob and the power of book clubs, why we will always need books, and a lot more. Stay calm and write on. And don't forget, you can always support this show by heading to writerfiles.fm, where you can also sign up for email updates, get links to merch, and other resources for writers. And if you're a fan of The Writer Files, please click follow to automatically see new interviews in your podcatcher as soon as they're published, and drop us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you tune in to help other writers find us. All right, we are back on The Writer Files. I am very honored today to be joined by a special guest today. We have an award-winning and New York Times bestselling author, William Landay. I hope I'm pronouncing your last name correctly, because I actually forgot to ask you how to say it.
You did great.
Fantastic. So, yes, I can't wait to talk to you about all things writing and the writing life. Of course, your latest, All That Is Mine, I Carry With Me. And this really, really fantastic career of yours. But let's talk about, take us back a little bit, because obviously you've had some acclaim as an author and definitely kind of seen some different sides of, you know, American culture as a former lawyer. But talk a little bit about kind of how you became a writer and just kind of the Cliff's Notes on how you got to this place in your career.
It's an interesting story. I'm not one of those writers who grew up knowing that I would be a writer or feeling compelled to pursue this. There were no writers or artists of any kind in my life growing up. And so it didn't seem like a realistic profession to aspire to. I always wrote a lot, and I had a facility with writing. I've always kept journals, and that's always been an important way to express myself and to think. I think of writing to me as an extension of thought. It's a, it forces you to think clearly. And so I've never lived without writing. But as a profession, it just didn't seem like something that one could aspire to. So I wound up going to law school and writing on the side, just as a hobby, nights and weekends. I would crank out short stories and things like that. In law school, I remember I was reading Lonesome Dove by Larry McMurtry, and a buddy of mine from law school, who was another bookish sort of guy, and I kind of fell into a long discussion about the relative merits of writing versus lawyering. And the thought was that a lawyer really leaves nothing behind. You might have a shining day in court where everything goes gloriously well, but then when you leave, there's nothing permanent or beautiful or enduring that's left behind. Versus a novelist like Larry McMurtry, whose books I always found kind of uneven, like most writers, including me. But even a writer who fails most times has the chance of creating a book like Lonesome Dove, a transcendent, enduring book. And so as I came out of law school, I had this idea in mind that there was something else out there that might be richer and deeper and more enduring. So as a young lawyer, I started writing. And as time went on, I joined the DA's office near Boston, where I live. And as you climb the ladder at the DA's office, your cases become more serious and you start doing victim cases. And it just gets so involving, so overwhelming that you can't write on the side anymore. And so as I came to my 30th birthday, I kind of thought, well, let's just try writing one time. And it wasn't a career choice. It wasn't, I didn't quit and devote my life to doing this forever. I just wanted to see if I could write one book. And the goal was just to, at first, the goal was just to see if I could get to the end of a manuscript and complete a novel length story. And then the goalposts continually move back as your expectations rise. And then the goal became to publish. And so I wrote a series of bad novels, bad manuscripts that never got, never saw the light of day. I never even tried to get them published. And eventually I left the DA's office to write full time. And again, it wasn't to leave the profession of lawyering. It was just to sort of see this through and give it a real try. And that's when Mission Flats was written, which was my first published novel, and was written while I was bartending at night and kind of writing during the day. Although if you've tried bartending at night, you will quickly realize that it takes a toll on your daytime abilities. So, and I had gotten married at the time, which wasn't a make or break in any way. The true make or break was my wife got pregnant. And at that point it was, I simply couldn't write anymore without bringing in an income. So we were at the obstetrician's office to check up on my wife's pregnancy when my agent called and said that that we had a deal for the first book. This was after 10 years or so of writing with various degrees of seriousness. And I wound up with a 2-book deal, which Amazing. Is good news and bad news. You know, the good news is you get paid. The bad news is you got to write a second book. So a 1-book project turned into a career.
Yeah. Well, see, that's a cool origin story because, you know, as you have kind of jokingly written the about the author as a part of your what home base there at williamlanday.com, it's funny because I clicked through and I read it and I was like, oh yeah, I mean, this makes a lot of sense. It's kind of like an essay about the author.
I've always felt that. I've always, the the gist of the essay you're referring to is that it interferes with the reader's experience to know too much about the author. You should be able to disappear into the story and forget that there is a person writing it who exists outside of the novel. And especially these author's notes that come in at the end of so many novels now, I just feel that it intrudes on the reader's experience to rush on stage right as the play is ending, right as the reader turns the last page and the dramatic climax of the novel should be ringing in their ears. And at that moment, the novelist decides to thank his agent and his editor and his wife and his whatever. I feel like at that point, the writer is better off just keeping his mouth shut.
So you think that the acknowledgments actually take away from the impact of the story?
Absolutely. And I don't think it's a mistake that Dickens or Hemingway or Jane Austen would have made. It's a trend. It's a fashion. I hope it goes away very soon.
It was heartening to hear you say that you had spent some time moonlighting as a bartender. And of course, who among us hasn't done that? But I think that's a great job for a writer, don't you?
I think it's a great job for anyone, honestly. It's a great people job, and it brings you out into the world. One of the big downsides of writing is it's such a solitary profession. And so I think that anything that brings you out into the world and puts you in a group of people, especially a bar, it's just a gregarious setting, and alcohol tends to loosen people up. So it's a good antidote to
that's right,
to the writer's dilemma.
Agreed. And I think, as you put it, the libations keep people telling one another stories, and often, you know, I mean, there's quite a bit of
bullshitting.
There's a lot of bullshitting. Thank you. And that's in and of itself is pretty funny, but there's also some always questionable characters that, you know, if you're at a place that is open late enough to kind of like, you can kind of sense the turn of the energy of the bar when you realize that, like, oh, this is that time of night when like some questionable people are kind of floating in and out. And
so true. Yeah. And people are transformed by drinking too, in ways that would be unrecognizable to their daytime friends.
Exactly. Well, very cool. A cool part of your about that we don't often see or hear about, but thanks for sharing that. But yeah, let's talk about the latest. And of course, you've had this this string of fantastic novels. This is your fourth novel. And as you said, Mission Flats was an award winner and won a Best First Crime Novel Award from the Dagger Awards. And then Strangler, of course, named a Best Crime Novel of the Year by the LA Times and more. But talk a little bit about, the difference in the reception of Defending Jacob, of course, which had just won a slew of awards and been nominated for some prizes, and also was recently turned into an Emmy-nominated Apple TV Plus show, right?
Yes.
Talk a little bit about kind of, did you feel a difference in kind of the reception of that one as opposed to the first two?
Well, in the reception, certainly. But I didn't feel any difference in the writing. And this is the thing that I hope people understand. You know, I had two books that were well received by critics, but didn't sell all that well. And then I had a third book that sold like crazy. And in the writing, I didn't sense any quantum leap in quality, and I still don't think there is. I think it's just chancy and strange how some books will find traction and others won't. And you know, it's not enough to be good. You have to be a little lucky too. I remember hearing an interview with Paul McCartney, And somebody asked him once if, when he was composing songs with Lennon, whether he could tell which ones were going to be hits and which ones couldn't. And he said that not only could he not tell which songs were the hits, whenever he tried to guess, he was always wrong. And I had a little bit of that experience with Defending Jacob too. It didn't seem to me like there was anything obviously better or worse about it, but it just took off. It had a very long tail too. It, you know, it hit the bestseller list, and that's one kind of rush, which I had never experienced before. But then it kind of got picked up by the book clubs too. And so it had a very long life. Your sales kind of settled, but they plateaued and didn't vanish. And it just kept selling and selling, and book clubs kept picking it up and picking it up. And I think that that is in a way more gratifying because, you know, you have the initial sort of rush when people are kind of reading it because it's fashionable. But when, at that point, later after that, it becomes purely word of mouth. And you get people who are really committed to reading, who take it up. And that's just a very gratifying part of the sales curve, I guess you'd say.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we've spoken with quite a few bestselling authors who have said the same thing, that boost from those book clubs and, you know, being able to continue the shelf life of a work is pretty, you know, again, it's like kind of just a blessing, I guess, for authors to be able to see it continually get picked up and talked about, which is really, really cool. A really cool story.
It's super cool. The other nice thing about it is, you know, it's such a personal, intimate way to meet a person. When you read an author's book, you are connecting in this direct, intimate way to another human being's thoughts in a way that's very difficult face to face. And so readers will feel a connection to an author, even though they've never met this person. And so I would get these emails from people who felt like friends, and it just went on and on. And it extends the writer's community in a way that is very interesting. You know, you have your intimate friends and family, and you have your acquaintances beyond that. And I feel like I got this gift of a third ring of connections to people who had read the book and felt that they knew me, and a community formed around it. And it's just it's a very cool experience, especially because novel writing and novel reading are both such isolated activities that these books that are created and consumed in perfect privacy then result in this web of relationships is just a super cool feeling.
And probably far different from the, you know, once a year or once a book publicity tour, mm-hmm. where now, I mean, even though during the pandemic, so many authors were stuck at home on Zoom mm-hmm. readings, which had to have been kind of anticlimactic. But I've heard this before, you know, being able to get out and meet readers and to feel the energy of being able to, you know, do a reading in a room full of folks that are connecting with your work is probably a pretty special thing. But also, as you said, that other ring of that other kind of tertiary community of readers has got to be pretty special.
Yes, it really is. It really is. I hope that there's more in-person readings for this book coming up now that we're sort of moving out of COVID, even though COVID has become endemic and hasn't gone away. I'm glad that the world, particularly the book world, is moving back out into the physical world because it's important for readers to meet. It's a small percentage of the population that really reads and that really loves books. And so for people to get together at a reading and be part of that living community of book people is important.
So I can't wait to talk about All That Is Mine I Carry With Me, which will be available on the 7th of March. And yeah, so the latest is a novel. Do you like to call it a legal drama? Are we calling this a... How are you describing it?
I don't know. I don't run away from labels like that, but I don't feel that I sort of fall between the stools. I don't know that any of these labels really apply to my books all that well. I think of them not as crime novels and not as legal novels. I think of them as mostly family stories that happen to involve crime and lawyers. I think because I come from a background of having been a prosecutor, that people tend to slot my books into those columns. And I think you could look at Defending Jacob and call it a legal novel if you want to. But it's not the way I think of them.
So do you feel like you get kind of miscast in a sense?
I think that I'm wary of labels like crime novel, especially mystery, suspense, legal thriller, only because I worry that those sort of labels turn off a more general reader who wouldn't be interested in what he imagines to be a crime novel or a thriller. I think that a lot of the book clubs that we talked about, that sort of mainstream readership, that audience really doesn't go down the mystery aisle of the bookstore or the suspense aisle. And I don't want people to feel like this, that my books aren't welcoming to them, because I feel that they are. And in fact, I think what's interesting about these books is they ordinarily people consume crime novels as a kind of fantasy and crime movies and television shows and so on. These are people who, for whom crime is not an everyday reality, essentially. And this is not news. I mean, people, ordinary suburban moms and dads have been reading crime novels for a very long time. People who go to the grocery store and mow the lawn will happily read about bank robbers and murderers and thugs. And it's a sort of fantasy. And one thing that my novels have tried to do, and in increasingly direct and explicit ways, is bridge that gap and present crime in a way that brings it directly into the lives of non-criminals, essentially, a general audience. And there's nothing especially brave or innovative about that. Many great writers have written stories that involve crimes. But I feel like that's that realism, that presence of crime in lives that seem secure and unruffled and not exposed to crime is shocking to people if it can be made to feel real and present in their lives. And so the last couple of books, including the upcoming book, involves ordinary suburban families whose lives crime comes crashing in. And the question is, how would you respond? How would you react? To me, one other reason I've always resisted that label of crime novels is I don't find crime itself especially interesting. And if you spend even a moment in ordinary criminal courts, you'll see that most criminal cases are repetitive and similar and dull. I'm interested in crime only as a prism through which we can talk about all kinds of universal, fundamental experiences and feelings and anxieties. One of my favorite quotes is from a psychiatrist named Robert Simon, who says that bad men do what good men dream. And I think that that really captures the appeal of novels about crimes. You can talk about these fundamental, universal issues and experiences in ways that are that embody them and dramatize them in ways that ordinary life and just speaking about these things in the abstract don't quite move you the same way. So that to me is the appeal of it. And the new novel is told in such a way as to steer into that realism and presence and authenticity of crime intruding on the life of an ordinary family. So that's been my interest with the last couple of books. What can crime tell us about ourselves? Not what can crime tell us about bad guy criminals in some sort of fantasy world or in a show about crime happening always somewhere else, always to a different sort of people.
Interesting. Yeah, that's a pretty fascinating way of looking at it. Crime as a prism through which we can talk about universal anxieties. And obviously, we have quite a few modern anxieties to grapple with in this kind of ongoing, in these ongoing concentric circles of crises that we so often are faced with. So yeah, I mean, it does seem like crime is having quite a renaissance for sure. True crime and so on and so forth. And obviously the 24 hours news cycle tends to kind of glom onto that quite a bit. I'm thinking of the Murdoch case I think it's South Carolina, which is kind of like always like, what the hell is wrong with this family? You know, like what happened? How did all these people die and all this money go missing?
And right. And then it is true that the sort of the media environment we live in, where we have such saturation coverage of all of these stories, even stories that at one point would have been considered a local story and you may not have heard about at all, creates an atmosphere of danger and insecurity and worry, always anxiety about violence and crime, because it's all you hear about. And it simply isn't in proportion to the actual level of crime and the actual statistical likelihood of crime coming into most people's lives. And yet the coverage creates this fear, and that fear takes up permanent residence in our emotional life. And we should address it. We should address it. And crime stories are a wonderful way to do that. And in some ways, when we consume crime stories, whether on TV or in novels or whatever, we are working off some of that anxiety. We're letting off steam. It's a release valve.
Interesting. Well, I could pick your brain about that all day, but I do want to get back to, of course, your latest, All That Is Mine, I Carry With Me, which kind of has a meta piece to it. We won't do any spoilers, but you are kind of, you know, the novel opens talking about writer's block. And of course, one of the protagonists is a writer researching so you're essentially researching a novel about researching a novel in kind of a meta sense when you're writing this novel. Talk about the process and the kind of the origins, kind of the seed of inspiration for the latest.
Yeah, well, as I say, the interest of crime for me has been lately about what it says about our own lives. And so I wanted to address this directly. And there's one way to do that is to break the fourth wall, to turn and address the reader directly. And that, in a way, is what's happening in that opening section of the book. The narrator in the opening section of the book is a novelist who bears a certain resemblance to myself. And has gone a long time after having a popular book. And that, too, tracks with my own experience. Defending Jacob came out in 2012, and it's been a struggle for me to follow it up with this next book. Not because I felt any particular pressure about following that book. It's just that each creative project brings its own struggles. And the struggle is simply part of the process, and it's bad luck. that it followed such a popular book. So I wanted to use that. I wanted to take advantage of the fact that when people open this book, more often than not, they'll be thinking, oh, this is the guy who wrote Defending Jacob. Whatever happened? Why such a long layoff? And I wanted to use that energy to the advantage of this novel. I wanted to take advantage of the assumptions and the questions that the reader would bring when he opens this book and starts reading on page one. And so the beginning of the book almost takes it as a given that you will project that narrator as me and use that to enhance the sense of realism that the book brings. And in some ways, the book occupies that uncanny valley between realism and reality when the authenticity of a book begins to seem like real life. And that is very much intentional, and it is meant to feel real. And the goal is to give the reader that little chill that you feel when a story hits very close to home. And that was a very conscious, purposeful intention of that opening section of the book.
Hmm. Well, congratulations on the reception of the latest, of course, described as a story that spans decades. A mother vanishes, the father's presumed guilty, and there's no proof and no witness. When the mother's remains are found years later, the investigation reawakens, and the now grown kids must ask themselves, can you really trust the people closest to you? Some really great blurbs here from some very fine peers, of course. Louise Penny called it astonishing, powerful, provocative, and worth the excruciating wait for another William Landau. That was nice of her to say. She's saying what we all thought. No, it was really cool to see Scott Turow and Joseph Finder blurb the book. Finder has been on this show as well. Super, super cool.
He's a great guy.
Yeah, but some really sweet, sweet peers, of course. Yeah, I mean, I guess in a nutshell, like when you are kind of hitting your stride, when you're actually getting pages and you feel like you're hitting a flow state, mm-hmm. In your writing process, what kind of a writer are you? What do you feel like is kind of your best writing day when you're kind of in it?
I'm very sporadic. I wouldn't even claim to know or to understand it, because I feel like those best days when it's really coming, I sort of disappear, and it's always a little trance-like and unconscious. And when you emerge from one of those writing jags, it's always a little astonishing to look back at this passage that you've created or this scene. Sometimes I'll read the prose and I'll know that I'm not actually that good a writer. Somehow it came out of me. It has a miraculous, inexplicable feeling to it. It is a magical feeling. That is really the most gratifying part of this job, is when you create something that you know is beyond your actual abilities. I think every writer's goal, or every writer of any ambition, his goal is always to work at the extreme outer limit of your talent. And when you feel yourself pushing against that boundary and actually stretching it, it's miraculous. It's transcendent. it's an experience. And the wonderful part about writing is that you are left with this permanent record of it. One thing that the experience of being a writer has taught me about novels is that the novel isn't the book. It's not the object that you're holding in your hands. That's just the residue of the activity. The novel is a performance. It's a it's an experience that happens in the moment. It's alive. And the magic of them is that it's asynchronous, that the writer's experience of creating the novel in a way is recreated by the reader. The reader is given essentially a script, but it's not like a TV show or a movie or music that the audience can consume passively. You're given essentially the sheet music. You're given the script, and you're called upon to pull those words up off the page. You bring your skill as a reader to the book, and you perform the story for yourself in your head. And that is that interaction between the prose and the reader's own active involvement in recreating the story for herself reimagines the writer's initial experience of writing it. And it's just a powerful, we've all as readers had those magical experiences where the book seems to come alive in our heads. And we've also had those flat, dead experiences of books that have never quite come to life for us. And when it works, when it really kicks in, it's just a transformative experience. It's such a wonderful, powerful medium. I'm so devoted to books and so not worried about books ever going away. Everybody worries about the switch to digital. And I feel like that's only a different platform for the same art form. I feel that we will always enjoy stories, and that magic of being handed a book and performing it for ourselves and bringing it to life in the intimacy of our own thoughts is one of a kind.
Wow.
That was more of an answer than you were expecting.
No, I mean, it was very philosophical and...
I know, I do go on.
Inspiring. I could listen all day. I kind of fell into a trance-like state. It was fantastic. Thank you. Well, we appreciate your wisdom, your words, of course. You can come back anytime. We'd love to chat some more. Before we wrap up, just with your kind of final pearl of wisdom to your fellow scribes, I'd love to ask you a fun one. If you could have dinner with any author from any era,
oh goodness,
to your favorite place in the world, drinks, dinner, what have you, on the house, of course, who would you take and where would you take them?
Oh my goodness, that's a great question. So many come to mind.
I can bring more than one.
But I think it would have to be F. Scott Fitzgerald, just because he'd be such a good time in his prime. And I feel like I would want to quiz him about his life. I feel like there's something about he has this romantic temperament that he was able to capture. And I would love to meet the real person behind those books. I would want to meet him in his jazz age happy state. I wouldn't want to meet the broke down Hollywood version of late in life Scott Fitzgerald, but I think no. Fitzgerald in his prime, I don't know if I could survive 24 hours with him, but I'd like to try.
All right. So basically you're daring yourself to go drinking with Fitz.
Exactly.
Okay. That sounds like quite a dare. Yes, that sounds like a blast. I'm sure whatever you drink or eat or talk about would probably
Wouldn't
be.
It be great? We'd go to the Plaza Hotel in New York in the 20s and we'd have a cocktail.
There you go. There you go. Probably many cocktails. So, just your final thoughts for fellow authors and just how to keep going, be it through the good times or the not so good.
Yeah, I would just pick up the phrase you just used, just keep going. And don't imagine that writing ever becomes easy for other people. I just went through a 10-year struggle to come up with this book. And I think that if another writer is listening to this, it would be easy to imagine, oh, that guy's made it. And it's all easier for him. I don't find that that's ever true. I don't find that writing ever gets easier. I don't find that one book makes you smarter or more expert or more ready to take on the next. It's a struggle every time. And if I'm doing this for another 50 years, I'm sure it won't be any easier. And so understand that the struggle is inherent in work that is this difficult, and just keep going. Just never quit.
Well put. The struggle is real. Bill, we can't thank you enough for your time. And do wish you the best of luck with the latest, and I'm sure it's gonna have a fantastic reception, and that you'll have a blast out there meeting your audience and your readers.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much for joining us for this file. And if you're a fan of the show, simply head over to writerfiles.fm for more. That's writerfiles.fm.